Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In 4 days, we will mark a year since Hurricane Helene devastated parts of western North Carolina, dropping up to 30 inches of rain and resulting in historic flooding, the loss of property and infrastructure, all at a cost of 108 lives, making Helene the deadliest storm in the state's modern history. The storm left behind nearly $60 billion in costs to repair and rebuild, not to mention the loss of income from businesses and individuals. Folks in that part of the state have spent most of this last year struggling to recover. Officials have been working on funneling available funds toward that recovery effort, and now attention is beginning to turn to the environmental damage caused by Helene. Animal and plant species experienced serious, sometimes fatal blows, and damage to forests and the pollution of rivers and streams was enormous. This hour, we turn our attention to nature and to the role climate change played in making Helene so deadly, as well as the environmental impact climate change is likely to have on the environment of that part of the state in the future. Andy Hill is High Country Regional Director and the Watauga Riverkeeper. He's here along with Chip Conrad, Director of the Southeast Regional Climate Center and Professor in the Department of Geography and Environment at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Welcome to you both. Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, you got to talk. It's radio. So let me start with you, Andy, because we've done a lot of programs since Helene on the recovery efforts that have taken place in various communities in western North Carolina, just to see how recovery is going in those areas. You're in the Boone area. Describe what you went through and have been going through since the storm arrived and where things stand today.
Well, Mike, thanks for having us. Coming up on a year, a lot has changed in a year. So sure we've all seen the news by now, but we've got, as you said, over about 30 inches of rain. The Watauga River came up over 20 feet, wiped out vital infrastructure like roads, wastewater treatment plants, bridges, left many without power for days and weeks. Significant change to the riverbed itself. So not only the destruction of the flood, but loss of the riparian zone, significant sedimentation of the waterways, pollution, as you mentioned. And since that time, we've been cleaning up, you know, planting trees, clearing the debris out of the streams, fixing infrastructure.
Let's talk about that, you know, because usually when we talk about recovery in these areas, we have focused on people, we focused on property, we focused on restoring roads and bridges and infrastructure and getting people back to work. But your life, your profession is focused on the environment of that part of the world, on waterways and forests and the animals that inhabit those areas. How would you assess the impact that this storm has had on those parts of our world, the natural parts of our world?
I'd say severe impact and devastation. And I'm personally, on a personal professional level, I was crushed in the days following the storm, both by the tragic loss of life, damage to the built environment, but I was devastated by the environmental changes. But as the recovery progressed, I was reminded that our rivers are resilient, like our Appalachian communities, and that rivers work on geologic time. This isn't the first severe flood event the Watauga has seen, and recovery, resilience of the waterways is going well.
Well, that was going to be one of my questions later in the program. Obviously, human beings like you work to restore things to the way they were or prevent further damage from storms that have come and gone. But nature kind of takes care of itself, is what I'm hearing you say, over time. Should people get in the way of that and advance it, push it along?
Well, it's an interesting question, Mike. Personally, I think that is our role as users and stewards of a resource to do all we can to jumpstart that natural recovery, because things Choices we've taken as human beings impact to the waterways. There are things we can do to mitigate the impacts of, say, stormwater runoff or development, jump-starting the recovery process. One of our favorite activities, especially when we're feeling hopeless and forlorn in the face of climate change and its impacts, is reforesting the watershed. So one of my favorite activities is planting live stakes, which are dormant cuttings of living trees. Think slips, cuttings about 18 inches long of native species like elderberry, ninebark, silky willow, silky dogwood, sycamore. So we plant tens of thousands of those throughout the Watauga Basin and other basins in West North Carolina every year. Really scale that up, jumpstart the recovery. So what we know is these native species will come back and propagate, but in sometimes, particularly following a severe storm event like this, you'll see significant erosion, loss of tree cover. And one concern that requires human intervention is the spread of non-native invasive plant species, things like multiflora rose, Japanese knotweed, oriental bittersweet, mile-a-minute weed, things like that. And the non-native plants can be detrimental to the local ecosystem. So one human intervention we take to increase resilience and recovery is planting these native trees. Planted about 35,000 trees since the storm. Plan to plant, scale up, plant hundred thousands more of this planting season. And I think that is a kind of a vital step from human intervention on the recovery of rural.
We're also here with Chip Conrad, who is studies geography and the environment at UNC Chapel Hill. It's been a relatively quiet hurricane season so far this year, although we do have a monster hurricane in the Pacific that's heading toward Hong Kong at the moment, and another in the Atlantic that's not going to threaten the East Coast at all. But last year, the big storm for us at least was Helene, as we've been talking about for that whole year. And the Weather Service has become increasingly accurate, or at least it had to that point, in predicting paths and when things would occur and what would happen when they did occur. At what point, remind us, Chip, at what point did we know that Helene was headed toward the mountains of North Carolina? And how soon before disaster hit were forecasters able to predict the path and what areas would be affected?
Well, first, I just want to you really emphasize your point that the National Hurricane Center and the National Weather Service have done a really remarkable job in their forecasting of hurricanes and their tracks. That has definitely gotten a lot better. And Helene, I think, really stood out in that the cone of uncertainty was a bit more narrow than the typical tropical system. And so they knew a couple of days ahead of time it was headed for the mountains. They didn't know the details of it, exactly where it was going to go yet, but they already had a sense that it was going to affect the mountains in a big way. A little bit late in the forecast period, as it was getting close to shore, it did scoot a little bit to the east within that cone, and consequently, it did come closer, a little bit closer. And while if it hadn't done that, we still would have gotten a whole lot of rain. There was that slight movement. But I will tell you, the forecast leading up to it were very accurate. And I'll tell you, the Greenville-Spartanburg Weather Service office, which is charged with making forecasts in Western North Carolina, had a really extreme statement about this, the potential for catastrophic conditions. So they really put this, I think, the strongest languaging they could put on the fact there was going to be very serious flooding.
Yeah, I have that statement. In advance of Helene's arrival, the National Weather Service said this, quote, "This will be one of the most significant weather events to happen in the western portions of the area in the modern era. Record flooding is forecast and has been compared to the floods of 1916 in the Asheville area." And it goes on to spell out almost perfectly what came to pass. What allows them to be able to be so accurate?
Well, one thing that happened too, it's just really unfortunate. There were two parts to the storm. The first part was called a predecessor event. There was a weak upper level low pressure system to the west, a stalled frontal boundary, Helene, being so large, was already pushing a lot of moisture up against the mountains. And in conjunction with the front, we had a training of thunderstorms, and they were basically rain bombs. I mean, incredible rates of rainfall were coming down. And so a lot of places got anywhere from 5 to 13 inches of rain, even before the main rain came with Helene. Weather Service knew there was a threat there, but once those rains had hit, then they knew this was going to be, the storm, of the millennium or whatever. I mean, later on, they estimated that a lot of the areas received rainfall that you wouldn't expect, maybe, and this is just really a rough ballpark, once every 1,000 years or less. And you think about it, once every 1,000 years, I mean, that you could go 10, you could go 11, 12 lifetimes without experiencing an event like this. So this was just an absolutely incredible magnitude, something the likes of which I'm sure none of the meteorologists had seen in their lifetime.
You talk about these rain bombs, and we're seeing these torrential rains that sit over an area for a long period of time in times outside of hurricanes. It's happening more and more frequently, it seems. And we were told that things like this would happen with climate change. We were also told that hurricanes would become stronger and wetter and cause more significant damage because of climate change. And yet, this has been, up until now, a very quiet hurricane season in the Atlantic, even though we have warmer than ever ocean temperatures. And last year was another year of the warmest year on record. Year after year becomes the warmest year on record. How do you explain the lack of storms?
Well, like any atmospheric phenomenon, a lot of ingredients have to come together in just the right way to make, quote, the perfect storm. And with hurricanes, of course, they drive their energy off the ocean surface. The warmer the ocean is, the more energy that they have to work with. And so certainly we're seeing a really marked increase in rapidly strengthening hurricanes. But there's other factors too that have to be just right. And one of those is what's called wind shear. And so for a hurricane to develop, it's useful to have an atmosphere in which there's not much change in wind direction or speed through the entire column. And with climate change, a number of the models suggest that there could be averaged out a bit of an increase in wind shear. And so there's a few aspects of climate change that actually can inhibit hurricane formation. And we've seen this year all kinds of factors. One of them is Saharan dust that's blowing off Africa and blows off into the main formation region in the eastern and central Pacific Ocean. And that can thwart the development of hurricanes. And it also can cool the ocean down. So I guess what I'm getting at here is it's very complex. And it's known that really climate change is certainly increasing the rate that hurricanes can intensify because they have a warmer ocean to work with. But it isn't clear actually that we're going to see more hurricanes or tropical systems in general. In fact, if you look over the last 30 or 40 years across the entire globe, there's actually been a bit of a decrease in the overall numbers of tropical cyclones, which would be hurricanes and tropical storms. So it's very complicated, but one thing we can say for sure is hurricanes are getting slightly wetter, maybe on the order of getting 10% more precipitation. And also that when they do form, typically there's going to be a warmer ocean to work with. And so they're going to, and they will have a tendency to intensify more quickly.
So when we come back, we'll talk about maybe what we learned about hurricanes from Helene and what they do to areas where they hit. And then we'll talk a little bit more about damage to the river and the ecosystem when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. As we approach the one-year anniversary of Helene, we are taking a look back on what Helene did and how climate change is impacting the formation and what these storms do. We're talking about that with Chip Conrad, who's director of the Southeast Regional Climate Center and professor in the Department of Geography and Environment at UNC Chapel Hill. And we're also talking about restoration of ecosystems that have been damaged by Helene, particularly in the Boone area. And we're focusing on Boone this morning because Andy Hill is with us. He's High Country Regional Director and the Watauga River Keeper. Before we move on to some of the ecosystem situations, Chip, one thing we know about all these hurricanes is that it only takes one storm to really cause major damage. I don't care what part of the country you're in, whether it's Miami Beach or whether it's in Western North Carolina, one storm will do you in. What did we learn from Helene about how these storms impact interior sections of the country, not the coast?
Well, I would say that more than anything, I think we were reminded that we see this phenomenon periodically. And of course, fortunately for us, you know, in the interior, in the mountains, we don't see hurricanes very frequently. But we can all recall, if we've lived in this region, that we've had hurricanes move inland. And so I think it was really a rude reminder that this can happen. The Weather Service, I think, and I can speak for myself here too, we were aware, you know, that you could get this kind of thing, but I don't think we realized just how extreme it could possibly be. And I think Helene, there were so many things that came together in just about, quote, the perfect way, to make this really the storm of the millennium. And I think no matter how wise you are or how much you know about meteorology, to literally see this happening becomes a learning experience. We learn more, but I think we already had certainly an understanding of the atmosphere and how this could happen.
Andy, in the immediate aftermath, everybody is focused on human beings and property loss and loss of life and recovery and getting people back on their feet. But a secondary disaster took place as well, not just in Boone, but throughout the mountains of Western North Carolina. And that's something that we really haven't concentrated on. You probably have, because that's your job. Mm-hmm. Are you getting sufficient resources to help you do that job, or has all the money and all the effort and all the attention been focused toward the primary disaster, which affected human beings?
We are getting some resources. One thing that we're particularly proud of at Mountaineer is our strong advocacy program. So that's, you know, generally focused on policy, both state and federal. Mountaineer is home to 5 river keeper programs across Western North Carolina. So that provides a kind of a powerful advocacy voice. Employ a full-time lobbyist in the General Assembly. And we work diligently on the 2 Helene relief bills that passed the General Assembly earlier this year. We made sure to include in these relief packages funding for our rivers. While it wasn't enough, I think, to put Western North Carolina back together, is certainly a good jump start. And one of those I'd like to highlight is a partnership with the Department of Environmental Quality. So this is the intersection between the human environment, the built environment, and the natural world. And so we were able to secure a $10 million grant in partnership with the Department of Environmental Quality. And we've hired full-time debris removal crews across Western North Carolina. So currently we have 10 crews working full-time removing debris from our waterways. To date, we've removed over 3.5 million pounds of trash. That's correct, 3.5 million pounds. And that's everything from cars and propane tanks to hand-picked litter like pieces of homes, pieces of fence, plastic bottles and bags, car parts, you name it. We found it and pulled it out of the river. Robust water quality monitoring program to test, you know, our water, surface water for safety. That's things like bacteria, but also chemical, you know, long-term data sets housed at Mountain True. We routinely test things, you know, the bacteria, but also, you know, pH, turbidity, nutrients, nitrate, nitrite, etc., to monitor the long-term health of the waterway and observe those changes. Kind of what happens after hurricane has been the focus. as well as biological monitoring. You know, what's the state of our native species? Things like the iconic hellbender salamander, native
Yeah,
fish, mussels, etc.
which I want to talk about. I would
Sure.
think that there's always debris of some kind in our waterways, but 3.5 million pounds is extreme. Have you or others who do your job similar to you seen anything like that before? And is it the sheer amount of trash that had to be removed, or that was the main threat? Or was it the variety of materials? Because it wasn't just fallen trees and debris from wooded areas that fell into the river. It was, as you say, car parts and motor oil and other things that have no place in natural rivers and streams.
So, great question, Mike. It was both sheer amount and variety. So, year in and year out, we do river cleanups, engage volunteers, got some trash trout litter catcher devices across the watershed. And that's routinely things like stormwater runoff, think single-use plastic bottles and bags. But what came with Helene was things like entire highways, railroads, railroad cars, shipping containers, cars, whole houses, things like that. And then in case of a whole house, it's everything that was also in that house. So you name it, we found it in the river. And there's a bit in there I want to circle back on, Mike, your question, have we learned from anyone else? But we've leaned on our colleagues in the Riverkeeper Network, particularly the Haw Riverkeeper, Cape Fear Riverkeeper, Neuse Riverkeeper, the folks down east who have more experience with hurricanes than ourselves, and kind of best practices on how to approach debris, what to look for when water quality monitoring. On the water quality monitoring piece, the intersection between the built and natural environment, we have the in-house water quality expertise to monitor waterways, so we're able to quickly after the storm assist our local health departments in sampling well water. One thing that's unique about the rural nature of Western North Carolina is most folks are on a private well, private septic. So understanding those impacts has been part of a puzzle as we move into from recovery to
I mean,
resilience.
you've taken 3.5 million pounds of debris out of the river. How much of where are you in the process? How much more is there to do? And what kind of a threat does this debris that you've already removed and the debris that remains, what kind of a threat does it pose?
So, Mike, we've been at it cleaning up since September 20th or 29th, and still have a long way to go. 3.5 million pounds is significant progress, and having these full-time work crews on the ground, they're out there 5 days a week, 40 hours a week, and we've got them on an 18-month contract. And we'll reassess at the end of 18 months how much trash we're with it till the job is done and the rivers are clean, cleaner than pre-Helene levels is our goal. Every piece of trash. And how much remains to go? I'd say a lot. So we're talking the all of our rivers in Western North Carolina, so Watauga, the New French Broad, the Green, the North and South Toe, and all of our tributaries.
You are also involved with an organization called Mountain True, and Mountain True puts out a swimming guide to let people know where it is safe to swim. How do you determine the safety of the water for swimming? And are you looking at debris, or are you looking at actual pollutants in the water that, if people ingest it, could get sick? How do you do that? How many waterways have returned to something like their pre-Helene condition, at least for swimming?
Great question. So Mountain True, home to five river keepers across Western North Carolina, and we operate a program called the Swim Guide from Memorial Day to Labor Day, and we test our most popular swimming holes. Think beaches, boat ramps, waterfalls, swimming holes, things like that, and we publish those results weekly to a free app called Swim Guide. You can download that app. It's free. Not only it's a great place to find swimming holes, but also to know if your water is safe to swim. So we operate on the North Carolina State Bacteria Standard, recently adopted E. coli standard for surface water after years of advocacy. Also the EPA standard, it measures E. coli and sets a threshold for human health, right? So we collect these weekly samples of E. coli bacteria is what we're looking for. And then we publish those results and it says, this is safe for primary recreation, which is swimming and snorkeling, Believe it or not, Mike, West North Carolina is home to some of the best snorkeling you'll ever be fortunate enough to experience. Think colorful native fish like the tangerine darter, also iconic species like the hellbender salamander. But the swimming has returned to normal levels. We're here. We've wrapped up our 2025 swim guide season. Our State of the River report will be forthcoming. But we put all this data is live on the swim guide app or at swimguide.org. You can view the data, and in most places across West North Carolina, water quality has returned to pre-Helene levels, or in some places, improved significantly.
When you have such an extraordinary amount of debris in a river, and the variety of debris is so extraordinary that things that do not and never fall into rivers are in these rivers and streams throughout Western North Carolina, what does that do to the ecology? What we know that fish and other wildlife in the river help keep the river clean, but what does it do to those populations?
Well, certainly, I would call it severe local impact. And the primary issue following Helene that we've observed that will have the longest lasting effect on ecological health is sedimentation. By sedimentation, I just mean erosion, stormwater runoff, bank failure. We're talking about mud. So the waterways of West North Carolina are unique in our state because they're generally clean, clear, cold water fisheries. Things like trout, native fish like tangerine darters, northern hogsuckers, are native mussels like the elk toe, the green floater, and the hellbender salamander. They all need really clean, cold, pure water, oxygenated water to survive. And when the influx of both, sedimentation and pollutants like commonly found in stormwater runoff, like elevated bacteria, brake dust, motor oil, petrochemicals, things like that can have a severe localized impact on ecological health.
Chip, when Helene brought flooding, it brought wind, it brought landslides, it took down thousands of trees. We've already talked about all the things that were swept away by floodwaters and ended up in rivers and streams and along river banks. How did Helene change the geography of Western North Carolina? And have other storms had the power to do anything similar?
Well, as was mentioned earlier, we get these storms, and when we look at it on a geologic time scale in the order of thousands to millions of years, those are storms that really shape the mountains. They shape the stream basins. If you're on a hike or something along any stream, you will see huge cobbles and boulders and things like that. And those were deposited from storms like this that happen once every 1,000 to 10,000 years. And so these storms are the big shapers of our systems. But of course, they do a lot of short-term damage. Then the streams gradually adjust themselves. But they're the ones that do what geomorphologists call the work of erosion to carve out the streams, and also on longer geologic time scales, carve out the many beautiful valleys that we see there.
And Andy, that's part of nature. That's been happening since the beginning of time. And what the Western North Carolina mountains look like today is not what they look like probably in 1300. Things are different, and man has changed the look and changed the geography. But when things happen so quickly because of a storm with the intensity of rainfall that Helene has, I guess they bring their own environmental concerns. Is this something that we just should look at as, well, that's what nature does, and do the best we can, or how should we look at this? I guess is the question. How do you look at it?
I look at it through kind of a data-informed eye towards resilience. And that's both resilience. What I mean is minimizing impacts to the I like to say the intersection between the built and natural environment a lot. So absolutely agree with Chip. Sediment transport, geomorphology, that's the natural function of rivers. But what we can do to alleviate or minimize the impacts is something I think is a conversation topic that's receiving new attention and new light, particularly in Western North Carolina. Activities we can take, like Removing obsolete dams off of the landscape, reconnecting the river to the floodway and the floodplain, also reforesting what we call the riparian zone. That is the tree cover, you know, the vegetation from the river's edge to the top of the riverbank, ensuring that there's a healthy riparian buffer, you know, it filters the stormwater. But that reconnection, you know, reconnecting the river to the floodway, something we take very seriously at Mount True. Ironically or fortuitously enough, just before, about a month and a half before Helene hit, we removed the Shoals Mill Dam with our partners at American Rivers and North Carolina Wildlife Resource Commission. And the Shoals Mill Dam on the Watauga River was an is an obsolete mill dam. Used to be a town called Shoals Mill, just outside of Boone. And in 1940, more folks lived in Shoals Mill than lived in Boone, which is the county seat of Watauga County, home to Appalachian State. And that dam had not functioned. It was a hydropower dam for the timber industry, you know, sawmill. And that dam was wiped out in that community in the 1940 flood. And that dam stood as a barrier to aquatic connectivity, sediment transport, kind of the natural function of a river until removal in August of 2025. And when you have these obsolete dams on the structure, we see in a rise in impacts of flood events. You know, some dam proponents argue that a dam provides flood control. We see in a non-functioning, poorly maintained or obsolete dam that these dams become hazards, and they'll kind of block up the river flow just enough to build a flood crest. And we either carve out around the dam, cause the dam to fail. We saw that, you know, in our own communities, like in Marshall, the Capitola Dam, dams in Asheville, Lake Lure, Chimney Rock, things like this. So I think removing these obsolete dams from the landscape, reconnecting the river to the floodway, being mindful of where we place impervious surface, these are all things that we can do to alleviate or minimize the
Well,
impact of future storms.
we're having these conversations about people who live along the coast with these recurrent storms that cause homes to fall into the land, bridges, into the water rather, and bridges to collapse. When we come back, I want to ask you, now that this storm has come and gone, and you've seen the damage that it did to property, when you've seen the damage that you had to remove from rivers and streams, should we do a better job of controlling where people live and where businesses locate along these rivers and streams and near forests and other natural areas? We'll get an answer to that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, home ownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. And Mike Collins are talking about the environmental aspects of the cleanup surrounding Hurricane Helene as we approach the one-year anniversary of that storm in the western mountains of North Carolina. Andy Hill is with us, High Country Regional Director and the Watauga River Keeper, and Chip Conrad, Director of the Southeast Regional Climate Center and a professor in the Department of Geography and Environment at UNC Chapel Hill. So everybody likes to be near the water. We know in Asheville, the Arts District was located on the water because not only was it a cool place to be, people like to be near the water. People have homes along rivers and streams. They do that because they like to be near the water. And as these natural disasters have become stronger and more damaging, as forest fires seem to be more plentiful, and yet people continue to build in forested areas, should we, Andy, be taking a look at that? Should we reconsider how close to a river or stream homes and businesses and highways can be located?
Absolutely. And historically, here in West North Carolina, where building space is limited, you know, commerce, agriculture, housing, you know, development of any kind followed our roads. I mean, our roads followed our ridges and our rivers, and because it's the easiest place to build and to travel. But knowing what we know now and the forecasted increase in the power of hurricanes, you know, climate change, we're getting more frequent severe rain events, potentially stronger storms. As we build back better, as we like to call it, I think a higher level of intentionality and certainty is warranted. What I mean by that is paying strict attention to new updated FEMA flood mapping, utilizing best practices, you know, minimizing impervious surface, doing everything we can to leave the river space to jump its banks. Yeah. When the river can reconnect with the floodway and the floodplain, one thing I've observed firsthand is where the river can disperse that energy, you know, when it jumps its banks out of the floodway, goes into forested bottomland, a wetland, the resiliency factor is much higher, resulting in, you know, less damage to the built environment, less impact, less loss of life.
Chip, you mentioned the predecessor rainfall event that the Weather Service noticed prior to the hurricane arriving, and that dumped 8 to 10 inches of rain on the mountains of western North Carolina before the hurricane arrived, which is what caused the National Weather Service back then to issue this extraordinary warning about record flooding being worse than the 1916 flood in Asheville. And it went on to spell out almost perfectly, precisely what happened, well in advance of the storm. How often are warnings like this issued in advance of storms with that degree of accuracy? And given some of the things that the Trump administration has been involved in terms of downsizing government agencies, including the National Weather Service, does that give them the tools, the personnel, the ability to make such accurate predictions about storms today and into the future?
Well, as I understand it, this is an evolving situation. We know that there were cuts that were made with the National Weather Service. Now they're making an effort to hire people back. I think there appears to be some recognition finally amongst the administration how critically important the National Weather Service is. And hopefully that gets extended to some of these other government agencies. But it's just absolutely critical. And the question there, too, of how frequently a Weather Service office issues a statement like this, I've only seen a few in my adult life, honestly. The last one I can remember was Hurricane Katrina, you know, as it was approaching New Orleans. Very, very dire warning, basically on the same level as this. But getting back to the main question, though, about really needing support from our government, I mean, state and federal, it is just so critical. And the scale of this event was absolutely jaw-dropping. I mean, it affected really all of the mountains in North Carolina, especially, you know, around the escarpment there. And there are so many people that were impacted. And many people really, I mean, while they love to recreate by the streams and rivers and so forth, there really isn't any other place for them to live because they don't have the financial means. And we have, you know, a single road that may go up through there right next to a stream with power lines. So their life support is all along this river. And so it's going to take a lot of funds to relocate people to higher ground. And just to get people back on their feet again. And that's, I think, what's so critical right now, because I know it's kind of a silent thing. We don't hear hardly anything about it in the news right now. But there's lots and lots of people who are still really, really suffering from mm-hmm. this event.
You know, the only thing I can relate this to is what happened in Charlotte with Hurricane Hugo. In advance of Hugo, and people don't remember this because this took place in the 80s, but when Hugo was coming, we were told by meteorologists, this is going to be severe for you in terms of what we were going to experience. And I don't think people understood it. And they woke up the next morning and they realized, my gosh, I have no power. Trees are down everywhere. I can't go anywhere because trees are across the streets. The power was out in some cases for 3 or 4 weeks in some areas of Charlotte, North Carolina. Now, you take a storm like Helene and put it in the mountains and the devastation is quantifiably larger and longer lasting. Andy, even with the warnings that the mountains got, Do you think that people understood, ordinary people, and did you, as a person who deals with the ecology of the river, understand what was coming?
No, Mike, I don't think that we did. You know, for years, I've been chicken littling up here, like, hey, we have to be more resilient, sounding the alarm about the potential impacts of climate change, about the potential dangers of devastating flooding. And I never imagined I would see such devastation in my lifetime. Many people view Western North Carolina as a, you know, a climate refuge, you know, free from sea level rise, generally cooler temps. You know, when you're down there in Charlotte baking in the summertime, we might, you know, we might hit 75, 80 degrees up here. I think, which is a real misconception that I personally held before the storm, that I think that was shared by others.
Well, let's talk about fish and wildlife and how they were impacted, because that's one of your areas of concentration. And you've mentioned several times in this conversation the hellbender salamander. You're very passionate about that creature. Tell me why and how they have been impacted.
Thank you, Mike. One of my favorite topics. So the hellbender salamander, for those who don't know, is North America's largest salamander. It's native to the southern Appalachians. We're really all across the Appalachians, but it's a species in peril because it needs clean, cold, oxygenated water and a healthy stream bed. They live under large rocks, rocky cobble, and they're a long-lived salamander. And their numbers are in rapid decline before the storm. And studies are being undertaken to see just how impacted by the storm they were, but the hellbender has kind of become a symbol of southern Appalachia. You find, you know, local businesses, local beers named after the hellbender. We have a giant mural in downtown Boone that we're very proud of around here of our native species, prominently featuring the hellbender. The Asheville Tourist baseball team played as the Asheville Snot Otters over a game this summer. So, the hellbender is having a moment in southern Appalachia. You know, it kind of, it resonates with folks. People here in Appalachia have a real sense of place, a real pride in where they're from. That's with, you know, natural cultural resources. But the hellbender is one of our favorites natives, you know, kind of a symbol.
And other species were harmed by this, or their populations were diminished by this storm. And have they returned? Have those populations begun to build back up?
Well, some of it's a complicated question, Mike, because we both had the impacts of the storm, but also the impacts of recovery. You know, the Army Corps sent help. You know, removing debris from the streams, using heavy equipment to get, you know, large things that we couldn't get out ourselves, like the railroad, train cars, propane tanks, then a lot of woody debris. And there are mixed feelings up here about the success of that. Some folks view the recovery as more damaging than the storm. Things like vital keystone species to the ecosystem, like our native mussels, like the elk toe and the green floater, were harmed. Our North Carolina Wildlife Resource Commission and research groups at Appalachian State University have been monitoring for decades and the plight of things like hellbenders, our native mussels and native fish. It's too early to call with any certainty the degree of impact. I think the impact will be known as we collect these data sets over years.
I understand your concern about this, because this is what you do for a living, and you do this for a living because you have a passion for it and an understanding of it. But given the amount of the toll to human beings, both in loss of life, loss of property, loss of income, etc., because of this storm, people may be thinking, well, okay, this impacted human life greatly. Why are we even talking about trout or the hellbender salamander or other creatures that live in the woods and in the streams? What's your answer to that?
My answer, Mike, is that they're all connected. So one thing we've learned that we know well in West North Carolina, tourism is our main economic driver. For years, Appalachia had an extractive economy, things like timber, hydropower, and now our economic model is tourism, and that's recreation-based tourism. There's an economic study that came out a couple years ago about the trout fishing economy in West North Carolina, and we're talking billions with a B. And tourism, that's everyone who comes to the area, not only to fish, but to float, you know, to paddle, to tube on the Watauga or the New River, to come up here and trout fish, but also to, you know, enjoy a scenic drive on the Blue Ridge Parkway or visit the Grandfather State Park, the Grandfather Stewardship Foundation, and experience the many delights. And one thing that when we saw post Helene is with our infrastructure gone, our roads and bridges out, the uncertainty about the safety of the area, our tourism went away, our jobs went away, huge economic impact. And it's vital for the future of Western North Carolina, not both the economic development, economic health of our region, but also these vital natural and cultural resources. They're all interconnected. So when people say, you know, why do the trout matter? Why do the hellbenders matter? They matter for themselves, but also for, you know, the broader issue. We won't have a robust, diversified tourism sector without clean water, healthy forests, clean air. And the things like the hellbenders, the mussels, the biological health of the streams depend on clean water, as does our tourism-based economy.
Chip, in March, WRAL Television in Raleigh ran a story stating that severe storms are intensifying in North Carolina and asking the question, is climate change to blame? I thought that question was answered, but is there any question about that anymore?
Well, we got to be really careful when we talk about this, because we've always had severe storms. We will have them in the future with climate change, without it. But what climate change is doing for certain types of extreme storms is intensifying them. And that's, you know, very much the case with hurricanes. I will tell you, with thunderstorms, we're not necessarily having more severe thunderstorms, but what we are having is a longer spring season. So our shoulder seasons are getting longer as the climate is warming up. And so we're getting a bit longer period, you know, each year, you know, in which we can get severe storms. So climate change is in there. It's very important, and we need to do things about it. But we need to recognize that living here, you know, in North Carolina, we get different types of severe weather. Climate change is adding on to that. And I want to say here, too, with Helene, climate change did not cause Helene. Helene would have been very bad without climate change. Climate change made it worse.
Okay. Climate change has resulted in these weather extremes, hotter summers, wetter storms, more frequent serious flooding, more forest fires. We've talked about recovery this morning, Chip. Are we taking adequate precautions to protect ourselves from this in the future? Are we changing, for instance, building codes or where people can live to protect against higher winds and more frequent flooding, etc.? And if we're not doing it, should we be doing it?
Well, we absolutely need to be doing it. And I think the government is doing the best they can, you know, given the resources that they have. But
when
we need
the government. Are you talking about the state or the federal government?
I know the state is doing a tremendous amount. I don't know much about what the federal government is doing. And I'm not going to comment on that because I'm kind of on the outside of it. But I will tell you with a lot of conviction, we need to be doing a lot more. I will also, too, in closing, want to say that a lot of people were traumatized by this event, and they're just very worried. And every day they're looking out there, you know, in the Atlantic or the Gulf, is there anything there? Is this going to happen again? And I want to tell them that while they need to be absolutely prepared for something like this happening again, this was an incredibly, incredibly unusual event. Very unlikely that they would experience an event like this again in their lifetime. You can't rule it out, and you need to be prepared. But we also just need to look at this in a pragmatic way. It was an incredibly unusual event.
Chip Conrad is director of the Southeast Regional Climate Center and professor in the Department of Geography and Environment at UNC Chapel Hill. And we were also joined this morning by Andy Hill, who is the High Country Regional Director and the Watauga River Keeper. Thank you both for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.